things. What does that mean, overzealousness? I could hear myself sounding panicky. I couldn't help it. It sounded like a euphemism for something far more ominous. The details are confidential, I'm afraid. Our internal investigation is ongoing. Running afoul of employment law by making a premature allegation to the press about an employee with a contract will not win me any points with the president. I'm not asking as a reporter, I said. I think Dekler might be... Right now I'm concerned about my safety, my family's. I have some information and I... Well, I don't even know what it means yet, but I need to know how worried I should be about Dekler. Thomas Price's face softened. He nodded but crossed his arms. Between us, there have been complaints from female students. Dekler made a number of them uncomfortable on more than one occasion. He's unnecessarily persistent. Just like he had been with me. Just like he probably was with Rose Gowan. I know Dekler's been here for a while, but do you know if he worked here back in 2006? Or if he left for a time between 2008 and 2012? It was one piece of the puzzle that I could confirm. Dekler's absence during that period of time would explain the substantial gap in the files. I don't think so. I don't know his resume by heart, Price said. But I'd be likely to remember those years. They match my tenure here exactly. Boom, boom, went my heart in my ears. Oh, yeah? I made myself smile. You left Ridgedale University and came back?
Yes. I came as an American Studies professor in 2006 to take over for Christine Carroll for a year while she underwent chemotherapy. It ended up being 2 years. The treatment was more complicated than anticipated. But when she returned for the fall of 2008, I departed for Wesleyan. I didn't come back to Ridgedale University until a few years later, and then it was as a dean.
He looked confused. But I wasn't. Not anymore. Not only did Price's tenure match the files, he'd taught the first 3 girls in the only class that connected them.
I'm sorry, I believe I may have lost the thread on our discussion here. What does this have to do with Dekler?
Jenna. May 30th, 1994. Tex cornered me today on my way to Spanish. Totally sketched me out. Kind of pissed me off, too. It's been nice having him be like this secret big brother to me, especially after that liar Todd Nolan started telling everybody that we had sex in the boys' locker room. He felt me up, and that was all. But I think Tex has gotten the wrong idea. First of all, he has a girlfriend, so I don't know why he's bothering me, especially because I have a boyfriend. Maybe not officially yet, but that's what the captain and I are. Together. And I've told Tex a million times that he isn't my type. Or maybe I didn't tell him that flat out. I didn't want to be a bitch or whatever. Besides, what I said should have been enough. But then, today, Tex got me all up against the wall, and he was like, be careful. And I was like, about what? And he was like, you know. And I was like, hey, no, I don't. After like 10 minutes of that shit, he was like, the captain. Be careful of the captain. And so, I'll admit it, I got totally mad, and I said something to Tex I shouldn't have. Something so mean, I'm not even going to write it here. I felt kind of bad after because I don't think Tex is trying to be a jerk or whatever, but he's wrong about the captain, and he's confused about us, but that's not even his fault. It's probably because his tight-ass girlfriend won't put out.
Barbara. Barbara was sitting on the living room couch, waiting. With each passing minute, she was getting more aggravated that Steve wasn't home yet. She wasn't afraid to admit it. She couldn't handle the situation with Cole on her own. But when she checked the clock on the cable box, she saw it was only 9:34 p.m. The community meeting surely had gone past 9, with Steve held up by questions afterward. He would come home as soon as he could after that, assuming that his phone wasn't dead or he wasn't so distracted that he hadn't noticed how many times she'd called. In any case, how many more messages could she leave? A second later, her phone rang. Barbara leaped for it, telling herself not to snap at Steve. No one wanted to do the right thing and then have his head bitten off for being late. But it was a blocked number. Dr. Kellerman, Barbara presumed. Psychiatrists knew better than to call you from a number you could call them back on. So nice of him to finally get back to her after Barbara's fourth page. Hello? This is Dr. Kellerman. He sounded annoyed. Thank you so much for calling me back. Finally, she wanted to add, but didn't. Yes, Mrs. Carlson, what seems to be the problem? The hell of their afternoon poured out of Barbara in an unstoppable rush. By the time she'd gotten home from Ridgedale Elementary and a stupid quick stop at the grocery store, which had stretched out because she'd been so hopelessly distracted by her miserable exchange with Rhea, Cole had completely fallen apart. Hannah had been in the kitchen, frantically trying to convince him that the red light on the smoke detector meant only that it was on, not that there was a fire. But Cole wasn't buying it. "I don't think so," he said, shaking his head back and forth and back and forth. He didn't even seem to notice that Barbara had come home. "Mom, he's not okay," Hannah whispered, looking terrified. "Why don't you go upstairs, Hannah?" Barbara said. Because Hannah either needed to hold it together or get out of Barbara's way. "Do your homework. Listen to some music. Do something to distract yourself. Because Cole is fine, honey. He's just fine." "Mommy, please put it off," Cole whispered once Hannah had headed reluctantly for the stairs. He was pointing at the red light on the smoke detector. Oh, and did Barbara rise to the occasion. She was a virtual model of motherly calm, smoothly taking the battery out of the smoke detector and handing Cole its lifeless shell. He was better after that, for all of about 10 minutes, until Barbara turned on the stove to make dinner. One look at that blue flame flickering under the pot, and Cole had jumped right out of his skin again. At least Hannah had stayed up in her room. She didn't even come down for dinner. It was true, Barbara didn't go up to get her either. Hannah knew what time dinner was served. Instead, she decided to be grateful for small mercies. After dinner was finished, Barbara spent at least a half hour trying to convince Cole that a wild thing couldn't possibly fit behind his bookcase. And while he was brushing his teeth, Cole asked her at least a dozen times whether a cat burglar, which he seemed to think was an actual cat, was going to crawl in the window as he slept. "No," was Barbara's answer each time. "No, Cole, of course not." All the while, she prayed she'd keep it together. And she did, but barely. It wasn't easy to sit by and watch your child lose his mind. "I can make space for him tomorrow morning," Dr. Kellerman said when Barbara had finished recounting their terrifying evening. He sounded so irritatingly matter-of-fact. "We may need to consider medication to stabilize him." "Medication?" Barbara snapped. "Wait, so things aren't bad enough to see him right away, but they are bad enough to drug him?" "That's one possibility, Mrs. Carlson, and only on a temporary basis. But it is important we keep an open mind." "We..." As though Cole were his child. As though they were really in this together.
"Bring Cole by at 10 a.m., Mrs. Carlson, and we can discuss all our options. In the meantime, try to stay calm."
"Stay calm? And what if we can't wait that long? He's not okay now, Doctor."
"At this hour, our only option would be the hospital. And I don't think that's where Cole belongs, under the circumstances."
"Where is he now, Mrs. Carlson?"
He's asleep at this exact moment, but then at this exact moment, the issue is really your anxiety, isn't it? It's completely understandable. This is an extremely stressful situation. Nonetheless, you'll need to find a way to manage your anxiety for Cole's sake. If you'd like, I can give you the name of someone to see on your own. On my own? Barbara asked. The only problem I have right now is Cole. I don't mean that. Cole isn't a problem. His problems are my problem. That's what I meant. Yes, Dr. Kellerman said, but not like he agreed. And then he was quiet for a long time in a way that Barbara didn't want him to be. Fine, she said, because she needed to get off the phone before she said something she would regret. But I'm going to call you back if anything changes. Otherwise, we'll see you tomorrow at 10 a.m. Absolutely call again if Cole's situation deteriorates. In the meantime, try to get some rest, Mrs. Carlson. It may take some time and hard work to get through this, but Cole will be fine. Children are extraordinarily resilient. Barbara tried to go to bed after she got off the phone. 9:42 p.m. and still no sign of Steve, and it was making her angrier and angrier with each passing minute. Did he really need to answer every last stupid question? Or was he not even at the meeting anymore? Was he somewhere else entirely? His only excuse would be that he hadn't gotten her messages. When Barbara got upstairs, she saw Hannah's light glowing in a thin strip beneath her door. Barbara thought about going in, telling Hannah to get to bed. But as soon as her hand was on the doorknob, it felt like a terrible idea. What if Hannah got worked up about Cole again? It would end badly between them. Very badly. Barbara was sure of it. And so she walked on, past Hannah's room, heading to her own bedroom, hoping not to open her eyes again until morning, when Steve would be there, and it wouldn't be long before they could see Dr. Kellerman. When she got into her room, she found her night table drawer a little ajar. It was where she'd tucked Cole's drawing. She hadn't let Dr. Kellerman keep it, especially when, at the time, she hadn't planned for them to ever go back. But she couldn't bring herself to throw it out, as Steve had suggested. Instead, she'd slid it in the drawer where she kept all her important papers. Had Cole been in her room? Had Hannah been snooping around? Barbara hoped not, but her daughter could be so maddeningly insistent. After the afternoon they'd had, maybe Hannah had been intent on finding out everything there was to know about Cole. Then again, maybe Barbara had left the drawer open herself. She couldn't recall, but she had looked at the picture more than once since hiding it there. It took Barbara forever to get herself to sleep, and when she just started to doze off, she was startled awake by a noise. When she snapped her eyes open, there was Cole, looming in the darkness, right next to her face. "There are bad things in my brain," he breathed. "Get them out, Mommy. Please." He had a bad dream, that's all, Barbara told herself. And bad dreams were okay. They were normal kid stuff. "It's okay, honey." Barbara pulled him into bed and curled her body around his. "Come here to me."
"But I'm still scared, Mommy,"
Cole whispered, sounding worried that the confession might get him in trouble.
"I keep having the same bad dream."
"Oh, Cole, you're not even asleep yet," she said. "You can't be having a dream."
"But I just did, Mommy," he whispered. "And it was so, so bad."
What to say to that? To a little boy's bad dream that goes on long after he's opened his eyes? There was nothing to say. And so she rubbed Cole's back, and eventually he fell asleep. Around the same time,
Barbara became convinced she might never sleep again. She managed to slip out of the bed without waking Cole. In the hallway, she could see that Hannah's light was still on. She was still not asleep. And Barbara still couldn't bring herself to go in and comfort her daughter. She simply had nothing left to give. And maybe that made Barbara a terrible mother and a bad person, but it was the truth. She could only do what she could do. Dr. Kellerman had been right. She needed to focus on keeping herself and Cole calm. Downstairs, Barbara checked the clock on the wall again. 10:23 p.m. Steve wasn't at the meeting anymore, that was for sure. "Damn it, Steve," she said quietly as she looked out the living room windows toward the dark driveway. Where was he? Soon Barbara would have to call the station. She didn't like to do that. The chief of police's wife having to track him down. It didn't reflect well on either one of them. But what choice did she have? Before she could dial the number, there was a buzz from the opposite side of the room. Hannah's iPhone vibrating on the side table. Hannah wasn't one of those teenagers that was attached to her phone, but it was odd that she'd left it downstairs. When Barbara picked it up, the text came through a second time. "I'm sorry. I should have said that before. For everything." The text was from Sandy, the girl Hannah had tutored. What was Sandy sorry for? Missing her tutoring? Barbara felt a queasy tug in her gut. "For everything." No, missing the tutoring wasn't it. Barbara typed in Hannah's password, her knowing it was a condition of Hannah having a phone, then opened the text messages between her and Sandy. Scrolling up to those that had preceded the new one, Barbara recognized many of the back and forths between the girls. From the beginning, she'd monitored them regularly. She had her concerns, of course, about Hannah socializing with the kind of teenagers served by outreach tutoring, and she wasn't ashamed to admit it. But the girls' exchanges had been so routinely uninteresting, about scheduling their tutoring, or where to meet, or the assignments. It had been obvious they weren't real friends. Not like Hannah's other friends, who, let's be honest, came with their own corona-swilling problems.
"Are you okay?"
Hannah had written to Sandy about a week earlier.
"Yeah,"
was Sandy's whole response.
"Are you sure?"
Hannah had pressed.
"You should go to a doctor. That was really bad."
"A doctor?
To check you out. Make sure you're okay."
"I am okay."
Barbara's heart had started to pound. What was really bad? More exchanges followed, all essentially the same. Hannah asking if Sandy was okay. Sandy assuring her that she was. Hannah asking again, over and over and over. Hannah was obviously worried about Sandy. But why? Barbara checked the dates of these very different texts. They'd started nearly 2 weeks earlier, right about the time the baby had probably been... Barbara bent over as the room began to spin. She was going to be sick. Her head was ringing. That Sandy girl had been in their house. Could she have had her baby there?
Oh, my God. Cole.
Had Hannah been lying all this time to protect Sandy? Had she chosen some worthless white trash stranger over her own brother? All Barbara felt was rage as she charged for the steps. Hannah's phone gripped in her hand. Then there was a sound. The front door finally opening. Steve. Barbara didn't care anymore why he was late or where he'd been. She was just so very glad he was there now. She sprinted toward him, diving into his arms and pressing her face against his chest. She didn't realize she was crying until she tried to speak.
"What is it?"
Steve asked. But she couldn't get any words out. He pushed her back,
shook her once, hard, as if trying to wake her. "What's wrong, Barbara? Talk to me. Is it Cole?"
"The baby,"
she said, waving the phone at him.
"It belongs to that girl Hannah's been tutoring. I think Cole saw something. I think whatever happened to the baby, Steve, I think it happened here."
"Barbara, what are you talking about?" His voice was raised, angry, alarmed, disbelieving. Barbara didn't want to believe it either. Didn't want to believe their daughter could be so unfeeling and cruel. Hannah had been acting upset about Cole, and this whole time she knew exactly what was wrong with him. Worse yet, she was the one responsible. Steve took the phone, his finger moving up and down the screen, his face hard and still. Finally, he took a deep breath and exhaled, rubbing a hand over his mouth. "Where is Hannah now?" "Upstairs," Barbara said. The look on his face was sharper now, the tired tinge gone from his eyes. He was in charge, a police officer on the case. Barbara felt such an enormous sense of relief. Steve was there, and he was going to handle this. Her anger at him felt like such a silly, distant memory, because they were in this together. They were in everything together. They always had been, and they always would be.
"Wait here."
Steve took a breath. "I'll be right back." Barbara was glad he hadn't insisted she go along. Things with Hannah were always so much better without her. Steve turned back at the steps.
"This. Cole, Hannah, all of it. It's my priority to get us through and make sure the kids are okay,"
he said, staring at Barbara in such an unsettling way.
"But once we get this all figured out, you and I will need to talk."
He didn't mean a casual chat. Talk? About what?
"I think you know, Barbara."
Barbara stayed there, rigid on the couch, holding her breath, trying not to think about what Steve had meant. All of that, if that's what he was even talking about, hardly mattered anyway. Certainly not now. She listened hard for Steve's raised voice, for the sound of Hannah crying, although she couldn't imagine Steve ever yelling at their daughter, even now. She braced herself for Hannah to come flying down the stairs, to run for the front door, to race off into the night. Barbara thought for a second about running out into the darkness herself, disappearing. Because she was overwhelmed now by the most terrible dread, as though something, an actual thing, heavy and dark and hot, had crawled up her back and attached itself to her neck. A minute later, there were heavy, fast footsteps on the stairs. And then there was Steve, his face tense and wide awake as he moved swiftly across the room for his keys.
"When was the last time you saw her?"
"What? Who?"
"Hannah, Barbara," he shouted. "When was the last time you actually saw her?"
I don't know. I don't remember. I was too busy trying to keep Cole together."
She scrambled to recall. It had been before dinner, at least. But she wasn't going to tell Steve it had been that long. He would never understand how overwhelmed she'd been by Cole. Maybe she went out for a walk. She does that sometimes, you know.
"Without her phone?"
He pointed to the counter where Hannah's keys sat.
"Or her keys. Her jacket's over there, too."
Steve seemed so angry, and at Barbara, absolutely furious as he grabbed his jacket off the back of the chair.
"Steve, where are you going?"
she called as he strode for the door.
"I am going to do what you should have done hours ago. Find our daughter."
Frat Chat. Here are the chatters in your area. Be kind, follow the rules, and enjoy the ride. And if you don't know what the rules are, read them first. You must be 18 to chat with the frat.
"How are we going to get Aiden kicked out of our school before he brings a gun or something?"
Three replies.
He told me he had a gun in his bag last week.
He did. I saw it.
You guys are so bullshit.
Anybody who could do that to a baby could definitely shoot a bunch of high school kids.
One reply.
Kill Aiden Ronan before he kills us.
Someone should tell the school. Anybody seen the girlfriend? Maybe she's dead, too.
Three replies.
I saw her once. Would be hard to tell the difference.
Dead or not, she's still hot.
Somebody should call the police and tell them.
One reply.
My mom told me the police already talked to his mom.
My mom can't stand his mom. She's a biatch. My mom says his mom hits on my dad, and my dad is totes disgusting.
Everybody send anonymous messages to the police today. Get Aiden before he gets us.
Molly. When I got home from the community meeting, Justin was asleep, a copy of Tender is the Night open on his chest. I'd raced up the stairs, intent on telling him about Thomas Price. But once I was standing there, watching him sleep so peacefully, it occurred to me that he might not be thrilled to hear how I'd felt threatened enough that I'd fled Price in a panic. Or that I had been especially petrified, mainly because of how utterly charmed I'd been by Price. He'd reeled me right in, just as he must have reeled in all those young women. And I wasn't young. I should have known better. God, I'd actually been flattered that he was flirting with me. I felt nauseated, thinking of it again, my hands still trembling as I lifted the book carefully from Justin and set it on the nightstand, then switched off his light. On my way downstairs, my phone vibrated in my pocket. Eric Skenazy. "Hi, Eric," I said, relieved it was him.
"Oh, hi, Molly."
He sounded surprised, as though I'd called him.
"I'm on my way back to Ridgedale, driving now. Just wanted to check in about the community meeting. Anything new?"
He also sounded nervous. Or maybe I was just projecting. Most of it was about the community DNA sweep they're planning. As you can imagine, people in town are not happy about it. I can't say I blame them.
"No other updates? No mention of that woman they were holding in the hospital?"
"No, there really wasn't anything new. There would have been nothing to talk about if they hadn't had the DNA testing. The woman in the hospital is still missing, as far as I know. I think they've probably ruled her out as the mother of the baby, though, or they soon will. Her baby would have been several weeks old." I pulled in some air, preparing to deliver the rest. It was going to sound insane. "But I do think there's a chance that she was sexually assaulted by Ridgedale University's Dean of Students. That maybe her baby is his baby. It's just not the one they found."
"What?"
He sounded shocked, as I'd expected. "I know, it sounds... It was surprising to me. But I think it's true."
"That's a serious allegation, Molly. Where's it coming from?"
He sounded as skeptical as he had when he'd put me on the story about the baby. Actually, he sounded more skeptical now. And he didn't even know that I was basing much of my theory on a box of files anonymously dumped in my living room. By Deckler, I was now assuming. My low opinion of Deckler hadn't magically changed. So why was I willing to believe what he wanted me to now? Like Eric had said, everybody has an agenda. It was definitely too much to unpack for Eric on the phone. Stories at the Wall Street Journal probably never started as inauspiciously as breaking and entering. Before I laid it all out for him, I needed my ducks in a much tighter row. "It is a serious allegation, you're right," I said. "And I won't know for sure until I make some more calls. Rose might be the best place to start. Come to think of it, she was a psychology student before she withdrew. Maybe Nancy knows her."
"I doubt it. It's a huge department," Eric said sharply, as though he wasn't going to bother his wife with my absurd theories.
"Okay, well, there's my friend Stella. She may have heard from Rose by now."
"Fine, follow up with her. And I'm not trying to be negative, Molly. It sounds like you have the start of something. I just don't want to make a libelous accusation against the Dean of Students without clear evidence. Once we have that, a comment from Rose or someone else, as you said, then we'll go after him full force. I promise I'll be leading the charge. He sounded regretful now. I heard him take a breath. And thank you, Molly, for all your hard work on the baby and whatever this turns out to be. You've done an excellent job with all of it, by any measure. Once I was downstairs, I spread the files out on the floor, looking for connections between Price and each one of the girls. The first three were easy. He'd taught the American Studies course as a last-minute replacement for Christine Carroll, the professor listed on their fall schedules. It took nearly an hour of cross-referencing various university sources, but soon I had linked each of the other young women to Price in one fashion or another. Jennifer Haben, 2012, had been an intern for the Dean of Students' office, and Willa Daniela, 2013, had worked in student services in the office adjacent to the Dean of Students. Rose Gowan, 2014, whose name Thomas Price had convincingly pretended not to know, had sat with him on a 7-member student advisory committee that had met weekly for the past 2 years. I was studying the remaining files when my phone buzzed, making me jump. I took a deep breath, not that it helped much. A text from a blocked number. Find Jenna Mendelsohn. That was the whole message. Who the hell was Jenna Mendelsohn? I turned back to the folders spread across the floor, wondering if I'd somehow missed a Jenna Mendelsohn. There was Jennifer Haben, but no Jenna and no Mendelsohn. Who is Jenna Mendelsohn? I texted right back, even though I felt conflicted about engaging. The last thing I needed was another mystery to solve. But already those three little ellipses had appeared, an answer on its way. She's missing. Then contact the police. The police are why she's missing. Who is this? I waited for the ellipses, but this time nothing. I was still staring at the phone when I saw something move out of the corner of my eye on the far side of the room. When I jumped and whipped around, there was Ella, standing at the bottom of the steps, gripping her blanket and trying not to cry. "Ella, what are you doing?" I shouted, way too loud and angry. I closed my eyes and pressed a hand to my chest, trying to slow my heart. Then I heard a sniffle, followed by a squeak. When I opened my eyes, Ella was full-on bawling. "Oh, Ella, I'm sorry." I rushed over and scooped her up in my arms. "I didn't mean to yell. You just surprised me. What's wrong?" She pushed back my hair to whisper in my ear. "The bugs. They're everywhere." One of her bad dreams. At least I was hoping. "All over where?" "My bed." A bad dream, definitely. "Come on, Peanut. You're safe. Mommy's here," I said, lifting her against me as I stood. "Let's go upstairs and get this sorted out." A half hour of lying in Ella's bed, rubbing her back, and she was finally back to sleep. I made my way downstairs, wondering if it was possible that I'd imagined the blocked texts. But the conversation was still on my phone. My last question, "Who is this?" still unanswered. And now I wanted to know who Jenna Mendelsohn was and what it meant that the police were involved in what had happened to her. "Why should I try to find her if I don't know who she is?" I tried again, hoping they'd answer me now. "Or who you are?" An instant response this time. "Because we know what happened to the baby. Find her and we'll tell you." "How do I know you're telling the truth?" "Baby was found with her head crushed. No one knows that but the police and me." I didn't know whether that was true. Steve hadn't told me those details, but it would fit with his reference to the condition of the body. It would also fit with how disturbed he'd seemed. Okay, what do you want me to do? There was no answer. According to Google, there were, unhelpfully, many Jenna Mendelsons, and none appeared to be in Ridgedale. I spent close to an hour clicking through all those other Jennas. It wasn't until I was so completely bleary-eyed that I accidentally typed a new query into my email search bar instead of Google's that I stumbled on something. An email from Ella's teacher, Rhea, one of several we'd exchanged back when I'd done the profile on her tutoring program. Subject: follow-up interview questions. Hi, Molly. Just wanted to get back to you with the names of some students from the program you might want to contact. The student I really think you could do an entire piece on is Sandy Mendelsohn. She's so smart and hard-working. I have such high hopes for her. She's really the poster child for this whole program. All the best, Rhea. Rhea had given me Sandy's phone number, too. I remembered leaving several messages for her at the time, but she'd never called back. I'd run the piece with comments from two other students Rhea was tutoring. I dialed the number and held my breath, gambling on the fact that it was Sandy texting me about Jenna, her sister or maybe her mother. I hoped I wasn't going to be the one delivering upsetting news. Hello? Came a wide-awake voice. Is this Sandy Mendelsohn? There was a long pause. Yes, she said finally. This is Molly Sanderson. I think you were trying to reach me? In the morning, I found Justin in the bathroom, already back from his run. He was standing at the sink, wrapped in a towel, neatening the edges of his beard with a razor. I think Thomas Price may be, or has been, sexually assaulting girls on campus, I said. I leaned forward and wiped the steam off the mirror with the back of my hand, so I could see his face in the reflection. Really? He stood motionless, razor hovering in midair, head tilted to the side as he eyed me in the mirror, concerned, wary. Where's that coming from? This has something to do with your story about the baby? He was probably worried about getting fired from his hard-won, beloved job, because I was rushing around making possibly groundless accusations. It would be understandable. I don't think it has to do with the baby, but I don't know. Right now, it's more of a hunch, anyway. Why was I downplaying it for Justin? I might not have been in a position to write a front-page story, but I wasn't pulling it out of thin air. Pretending otherwise wasn't going to help either of us. No, it's more than a hunch. I'm pretty sure it's true. I just don't have enough evidence to do anything about it. Justin shook his head in disgust, then leaned closer to the mirror and went back to shaving. I don't want to say I told you so, but you know I never liked that guy. I'll warn you before I do anything. I know that my making that kind of allegation against Price could be disastrous for you. To be honest, I'm trying to figure out the right thing to do. Well, don't worry about me. He looked almost offended. If what you're saying is true, Ridgedale University isn't going to want to defend him. And even if they do, I'll support you, Molly. Whatever you decide. Ridgedale Reader. Online edition. March 19th, 2015. 8:27 a.m. At Ridgedale Community Meeting, police announce DNA testing. By Molly Sanderson. Police officials held a public meeting last night at the Ridgedale University Athletic Center to discuss the ongoing investigation into the death of the infant found near the Essex Bridge. Chief of Police Steve Carlson answered questions for over an hour. The baby's cause of death has not yet been determined, and she remains unidentified. In an effort to assist in identification, the Ridgedale Police Department is to begin voluntary, community-wide DNA testing. It will take place at the Ridgedale Police Department over the next 3 days. Hours of testing, as well as a detailed explanation of procedures, are available online at ridgedalenj.org. David Simpson, Esquire, a criminal defense attorney and Ridgedale resident, has invited anyone concerned about the legal implications of DNA testing to contact him for a free consultation.
Comments. Marnie B.
DNA testing? Are they insane?
Gail.
Seconded. This can't be legal.
Stephanie. They are definitely trying to scare whoever's responsible out of the closet. It's probably not even really the girl's fault. Who knows what her life is like? Maybe her mom has to work 3 jobs or something. Bad parents aren't born, you know. They're made.
Mom 22.
I don't have a teenager, but if I did, there is no way I would let them give a sample. What is this, 1984? Life is living.
I would have my children give a blood sample if it would help find out who did that to their baby. Someone needs to send a message to these kids who apparently aren't too young to have sex, but think they're too young to be held accountable.
Saren B.
Are you telling me you think that this was just some teenager who couldn't be bothered to put her child up for adoption? Do you really think people are that cruel?
246 Barry.
Shut up and find him before he finds you.
Carol and the pups.
Ugh, not this jerk again. 246 Barry, no one wants you here.
Samuel L.
Just called you into the police, 246 Barry. How you like that? Turns out they already know about you. It's all fun and games until you get arrested for harassment and your name is plastered all over the place. Because then it won't matter if the police don't do anything about you. Because the rest of us will.
Jenna. June 11th, 1994. The captain is coming at 8 p.m. He said he's totally up for meeting my parents, too. I just hope they don't mess it up for me by acting like they think I'm a total nutbag. At least my dress is so cute. It's red and has this deep V that totally shows off everything. My mom didn't even give me crap about it. It's because she knows who the captain's family is. I think she hopes I'll snag him for good. Then maybe she'll stop spending all her free time praying for my mortal soul. And I'm just not going to think about Tex being at the party. Because he will be. And he's totally going to try to kill my buzz. Telling me to be careful and whatnot. Like that's the real point, and not that he wants me putting out for him instead of the captain. But I'm not going to let him make me feel bad for getting the guy I always wanted. The kind nobody, not even my own parents, thinks I'm good enough for. It would be a lot easier if I just hated Tex, though. If I didn't kind of also like that he cares about me. Then I could tell him to get the hell away from me forever. But it's not that simple. Nothing ever is.
Sandy. Sandy sat in a sticky booth at the back of Pat's Pancakes, waiting for Molly. The place was practically empty, unlike on weekends when a line snaked out the door. A half dozen mostly old people were in the booths, eating their omelets and pancakes so slowly it was like they were being paid by the minute. "What can I get you, hon?" The waitress snapped open her pad. She was pretty, or used to be. Now she had a fuzzy ponytail and a super wrinkled face, but didn't seem that old. That was what Jenna would look like eventually, if she got the chance. Someday, Sandy thought, I'll probably look like that too. "Can I have a coffee?" Sandy asked. "Just coffee?" The waitress wasn't trying to be a bitch, Sandy knew. She was just trying to pay her bills. "Yeah, for right now," Sandy said. "I'm waiting for somebody." She'd have to hope that this Molly woman would order some food when she got there. Sandy couldn't afford to waste money eating when she wasn't hungry, even to keep a fellow waitress happy. And she hadn't been hungry in days. Of course, that hadn't stopped Aiden from trying to stuff her like some overprotective grandmother the night before.
"I got crap for a sandwich, and some chips and cookies and an apple," Aiden had said, tossing a bunch of food into a pile on his bed.
He had been right about it being easy to sneak in the back door, and Sandy felt almost safe now that they were upstairs in his bedroom, behind his locked door. She looked down at all the food Aiden had swiped from the kitchen. There was even lettuce and a tomato, and a pretty little jar of something that might have been mustard, because people who lived in houses like Aiden's didn't make ham and white bread sandwiches with French's mustard, the way Sandy always had. Aiden was staring down at the pile like he'd never made his own sandwich in his entire life. Like he had no goddamn idea where to start.
"Thank you," Sandy said, keeping her eyes on the food, because she couldn't handle looking right at Aiden. "For letting me come here." Because where the hell had she been planning to go? She hadn't been planning. That was the bottom line. She just wanted to get away from Hannah's dad, lurking outside Ridgedale Commons. And so she just kept pedaling, until she was sure no one was following her. She didn't realize until too late that it was getting dark and she didn't have a plan. Despite what she'd been thinking, she couldn't sleep outside. Amazing how something like that could seem like a legitimate fucking option. "Whatever, I'll just sleep outside if I have to." Until you started working through specifics. Where outside? In the woods? On the sidewalk? To begin with, it was too cold. And it wasn't like people in Ridgedale wouldn't notice another person sleeping on the street. There weren't any other people on the street. Sandy was hoping Aiden wasn't going to make her eat. She wasn't sure she could make herself swallow anything. But she was thirsty as hell. Couldn't remember the last time she'd had something to drink. Felt like never. Sandy polished off two of the fancy glass bottles of lemonade Aiden had dropped on the bed, one after the other, before she looked back up. When she finally did, Aiden was staring at her with wide, freaked-out eyes. For the first time, he was getting just how fucked she was. She must have seemed like some kind of animal, drinking like that. She sure as hell felt like one. "Sorry," she said, wiping her dirty mouth with the back of her dirty hand.
"Nah, it's cool,"
Aiden said quietly as he sat down on the bed next to her. He was looking down at his own perfectly clean hands, probably wishing he'd never invited Sandy over. He'd said he wanted to help, sure, but it was one thing to play at the edges of her fucked up life. It was another thing to take up center stage.
"I can take off, you know," Sandy said. She felt bad putting all this shit on him. "No hard feelings. I don't want you to feel, like, necessary."
Aiden took the bottle of lemonade, Sandy's third, from her hands, took a sip, and handed it back to her.
"Oh, I'm not necessary," he said, turning to look at her. "I'm fucking essential."
In the morning, when Aiden kissed Sandy goodbye on his way to school, she knew it might be the last time she'd see him. That maybe it should be. But the plan was for Sandy to slip out later, after Aiden's mom and little brother had gone. She was supposed to meet up with Aiden after he was out of school.
"See you later," he said. "I'll text you."
It had made a difference, Aiden being there. But when you lived in the middle of a shitstorm, the question wasn't whether things were going to fly apart. It was when. The least Sandy could do was keep Aiden clear of the shrapnel. After he was gone, Sandy pulled her mom's journal out of her backpack and lay on the floor, tucked behind his bed, praying his mother didn't charge in to toss the place for drugs or something while she was there. Jenna had already told Sandy some of what was in the journal, enough for Sandy to have known the exact place where the whole fucked-up story ended.
enough that Sandy would have sworn nothing she read could make it worse. But she should have known better. With Jenna, things could always get worse. What if Jenna had decided that she couldn't take the memories anymore? That was all Sandy could think when she was done reading the journal. What if coming back to Ridgedale had been about Jenna finding an ending instead of a fresh start? No, Sandy didn't believe that any more than she believed that Jenna had taken off. And maybe that made her as stupid as anyone else who fell for Jenna's shit. But she didn't, wouldn't believe it. Sandy had a flash of a memory then, her and Jenna dancing. She'd been barely 10, and they'd been in their shitty apartment in Camden, the one with a gas stove with only one burner that worked, and that whack-ass blue-green mold streak on the living room wall. That day the sun had been so bright in the window that the place hadn't looked so bad, especially with Jenna trying to teach Sandy how to cha-cha. Jenna had her black hair piled on top of her head, a cigarette pinched between her red lips, as she swung her hips back and forth in her worn, skin-tight leggings, trying to get Sandy to match her steps. There wasn't much that Sandy remembered from her childhood, but the particular bump in the road that came before that dancing stood out because it had rolled right over her 10th birthday. Her welcome into double digits had been totally forgotten in the 3 straight days Jenna hadn't gotten out of bed and wouldn't stop crying, even though Sandy brought her endless Diet Dr. Peppers and wine and Cheetos. Some guy, another guy like all the other guys, had broken Jenna's heart. But by that afternoon, when Sandy was 10 years and 4 days old, they were dancing. And Sandy knew once again that they'd make it, at least this time. "You're getting it! You're getting it!" Jenna had squealed with delight when Sandy had been able to follow along. "Look at you! That's it!" Jenna had looked so happy as they danced to the blasting Kid Rock that was definitely not meant for the cha-cha. So happy she might burst. Because that was Jenna. So bad, and then so, so good. Jenna wouldn't kill herself. It wasn't possible. She always rebounded, and she rebounded hard. She might have come back to Ridgedale looking for something or someone, Tex, maybe. If he'd looked out for her back then, maybe Jenna thought he'd do it again. That Sandy could see Jenna doing, dragging them here because she had some twisted idea that her knight in shining armor would still be hanging around all these years later, waiting to rescue her once and for all. "Sandy?" When she looked up, there was a woman standing next to the booth in Pat's Pancakes. Pretty, with pale skin and long, curly, reddish hair. Molly looked nice and normal, like a regular mom, but not in a bad way. It had been Aiden's idea to text her the night before. She was a reporter, his mom's friend. Somebody who might be able to help. "Yeah," Sandy nodded, feeling a lot more nervous than she'd counted on. "I'm Molly Sanderson." The woman reached out a hand as she sat down in the booth across from Sandy. "I don't know if you remember, but I actually called you a few months ago when I was doing a story on the outreach tutoring program. Rhea gave me your number." "Oh, right," Sandy said, even though she didn't remember. At least that explained how the hell Molly had tracked her down so fast. "Jenna is your mom, I'm guessing?" Sandy nodded, then shrugged. "But she's not your usual kind of mom." "I'm not sure there is such a thing," Molly said, which was nice. She didn't have to say that. "So you said she's missing?" "She left Blondie's after work a couple days ago and never came home," Sandy said. "She's kind of a screw-up. Totally a screw-up. But not like this. She would call me." "I believe you," Molly said. And it actually seemed like she did. "It sounds like you went to the police already." "I did. The chief of police, Steve. He was nice and everything, and he said he would help." But then I found this in his house. She put the necklace on the table and slid it across. It's my mom's. She never takes it off. Molly reached forward to take it. She looked concerned. Why were you in his house? I didn't break in or anything. I was just looking through his shit to steal drugs. I know his daughter. Would your mom have any reason to know Steve? I don't think so, unless he arrested her. That could be, except she never mentioned it, and she would have. She tells me everything. But he definitely had this weird look on his face when I said her name. Did you ask his daughter? Ask her what? If her dad knows your mom. I can't really ask her anything right now. Sandy shook her head, tried not to notice how raw her throat felt. She's kind of checked out. She'd been lying when she texted Molly that she would tell her what happened to the baby. Sandy was going to get what she needed from this reporter, and then the woman could go to hell. No offense. What had happened to that baby was a secret Sandy would take to the grave. She hadn't even explained it to Aiden, who'd been nice enough not to ask how the hell she could have known what had happened to the baby's head. You could go to the other police, you know, Molly said, like she was really trying to help. The state police, maybe? I can't. Sandy shook her head. She had to hope this woman would drop it. I mean, I really can't. Trust me. Okay, Molly said, backing off the way Sandy had wanted her to. Let me just think for a minute. She stared at the table. When she looked up, she crossed her arms, her face tougher. I'll do it. I'll ask him why he had the necklace. And if he doesn't have a good answer, or he hasn't done enough to find your mother, I'll go to the state police myself. One way or another, we'll find out what happened to her, Sandy. I promise. Then Molly leaned forward and put her hand over Sandy's, and there were the tears in Sandy's eyes again. Seriously? Was this all it took? For some nice, normal-looking woman to be a little bit kind to her, and she totally fell apart? Okay, Sandy said, and that was all she could manage. She nodded and turned toward the window. But Sandy, whatever happened to the baby, and I'm not saying it was you, whoever, whatever was involved, these things don't just go away, no matter how much you hope they will. And the harder you try to force them down, the harder they push their way back to the surface. I'm saying that from personal experience. Molly looked sad. It can help if you tell someone what happened. I can be that person for you, Sandy. And I'm a lawyer, or I used to be a lawyer. I can be your lawyer for the purposes of this. That way, no one can make me tell them what you told me. All you have to say is that you want me to be your lawyer. I want you to be my lawyer, Sandy said. But that wasn't what she was thinking. She was thinking, I want you to be my mother. Sandy hadn't wanted to go to Hannah's house for their tutoring session. She'd been hoping she'd never have to see where Hannah lived, never have to feel all that cozy love pouring out from the walls. But Hannah had said she was stuck home, watching her brother. She offered to reschedule, but Sandy wasn't ready for her math quiz, and if she wasn't prepared, if it didn't seem like she'd tried, Maria would be crushed. The house was basically the nightmare Sandy had dreaded. Nothing fancy like Aiden's, but cheerful as all fuck. To-do lists and chore charts and newspaper articles labeled with post-its and highlighting. There was one of those personalized calendars with pictures of Hannah and Cole and a big red circle around March 31st. Hannah's recital! My parents won't be home for at least an hour and a half, and Cole's watching TV. If it's okay with you, could we study here at the table? In case he needs anything. Hannah moved a stack of placemats and a little vase of flowers, then dropped her books in the center of the table. Do you want something to drink or anything? I'm good, Sandy said. She just wanted to get the whole thing over with and get the hell out of that house, because it was so fucking hard to breathe in there. It was how Sandy always felt whenever she was anywhere too normal.